UK Wine Show, show number 199. Greg Dieb from Crown Wine Cellars in Hong Kong. G'day, my name's Chris Scott and welcome to this week's UK Wine Show. This week we're talking with Crown Wine Cellars. They provide high quality wine storage in Hong Kong. And we talk with Greg Dieb about wine storage conditions and how the booming Hong Kong fine wine market copes with subtropical temperatures. In the spotlight, we're looking at autolysis. I'm recording the show this week in New Zealand. I've just spent the last couple of days in Marlborough, and I've recorded some fascinating shows all about reduction with the winemakers and viticulturists from Cloudy Bay. I've been over to Yealands, one of New Zealand's largest independent wine producers, or privately owned wine producers. And I've also spent a bit of time with a climatologist talking about frost and frost protection. So lots of interesting shows there. And today I'm heading down to Waipara to see Pegasus Bay and going to talk to some people about Carbon Zero as well. So quite a lot of shows being recorded in the last few days. Right, let's crack on to with this week's show, and we start off with our mystery wine producer. And as usual, I'm going to give you two sets of clues, one now and one after the news. And I want you to try and work out who you think the producer is. I'll give you the answer and all the clues again at the end of the show. So our mystery wine producer was established by Ivan Jakic, selling wine to American soldiers during World War II. He named the winery after the word meaning mountainous, as his vineyard was on the slope of the Waitaki Ranges west of Auckland in New Zealand. In the 1960s, his sons planted vines in Gisborne, and by the 1980s, they led the way into the Marlborough region. That should give you a few clues. I'm going to give you more clues after the news, which is coming up next with me, sorry to say. I'm still doing the news. Hopefully next week I'll be back in England early enough so that Jane can read the news. But at the moment, you've got me for the news. Okay, first story, since we're talking about Greg Dieb from Hong Kong, is BBR opens a second shop in Hong Kong. Berry Brothers and Rudd have opened their second store in Hong Kong in the city's financial district. But it's been quite a wait. They started trading in Hong Kong 11 years ago with a website and wine club, and they opened their first store in Causeway Bay in 2003. The new store is within the new Alfred Dunhill complex and features around 400 wines starting at around £40 a bottle, so not cheap stuff there, that's for sure. The wines can also be drunk in the adjoining restaurant Alfie's, free of any corkage charge, which is always quite good. The next story is Fake Bolly in London. Counterfeit bottles of Bollinger Champagne have been found in small retailers and bars in Holland Park, West London. The bottles haven't appeared in any supermarkets, and according to training standards, they're being sold by cases to off-licenses and news agents in the area. Champagne Bollinger's UK agent, Metzendorf, says that they've been working closely with trading standards since before Christmas when the first bottles were discovered. Only a small quantity of stock is involved, and labels of poor quality and photocopies applied to bottles of cheap sparkling wine sourced from the continent. I suppose one of the things when I was in Hong Kong was I was a bit worried about forgeries in Hong Kong. People talk about fake this, fake that coming out of China. And the Hong Kong people seem to think that a lot of the forgeries are coming from Europe. And it certainly looks that that's the way as well. Do read The Billionaire's Vinegar if you want to find out lots about fake wines. Then the last story is Italy's first non-alcoholic wine. Italy's first de-alcoholized wine has been launched, called Wine Zero. The wine will be available in red, white and rosé and contains 0.5% of alcohol, as it's impossible to remove 100% of the alcohol. To remove the alcohol, the wine is deconstructed, separating the alcohol from the rest of the components. It's then rebuilt without the alcohol. Friends and co-founders of Wine Zero, Manuel Zanilla and Massimiliano Bettinelli, use Spanish grape varieties Tempranillo and Verdecco to make the wines, but hope to introduce new varieties made from Italian grapes and expand the brand outside Italy. Just one thing, technically it's not wine in the EU. Anything under about 8.5%, I think it is, can't be called wine. So when I read a lot of the articles on this, I was quite surprised that people were calling it wine, which it's not. It's de-alkalized grape juice, I think is what they call it, or something beautiful like that. That ends the news this week. Next up, though, we've got our spotlight. Now, the spotlight this week, we're just looking at autolysis. So here's the spotlight. To get the bubbles into fizz using traditional methods, as used in champagne, they add sugar and yeast to the base wine. The yeast eats the sugar and converts it to alcohol and carbon dioxide, which is how the bubbles are produced in champagne. Once the sugar is consumed, the yeast starves to death. It sinks to the bottom of the bottle, and after a year or two, the yeast, often called lees, starts to break down and decompose. That releases a bready, yeasty, biscuity aroma into the wine. The process of breaking down is known as autolysis, and the flavours are sometimes known as autolic. As well as encouraging flavour development, the dead yeast releases amino acids and proteins, as well as glutamates, which are known as umami. So wines that undergo autolysis are often relatively high levels of umami, and you'll find that those sort of wines often go quite nicely with salty dishes. The way the breakdown, or dead yeast, or lees, it does take quite a while. So wines that are normally had less than, say, 9 months to a year of contact with the dead yeast normally don't pick up any bready, yeasty aromas. By the time you get to about 3 years, and particularly for 5 years for vintage sparkling wines, vintage champagnes, there's a lot of autolysis in the wine. From autolysis to a producer of sparkling wines, next up we have our mystery producer. And the last clue in our mystery producer today is our mystery New Zealand producer is owned by Pernod Ricard and is the largest producer of wines in New Zealand. They have a range of wines at different prices, starting from the classic range, then they have their reserve range, terroir series and letter series, as well as quite a few sparkling wines. The reserve range is a premium wine representing the different regions and grape varieties. The terroir series focuses on presenting the grape varieties grown in different sites across the region. And the letter series are wines handcrafted from grapes grown in their top estates. Whenever we think about that, I'm going to give you the answer after the interview, which is coming up next with Greg Deep about Crown Wine Cellars, and we'll see where you get to with that. Let's have a listen to what Greg says about Crown Wine Cellars and wine storage in Hong Kong. Hi, my name's Chris Scott. I'm here with Greg Dieb from Crown Wine Cellars. How are you, Greg?
Very well, Chris. Good to have you here.
Excellent. We're actually in Hong Kong. I've just got off the plane this morning, so I'm a bit jet-lagged.
Welcome.
So hopefully I'll manage to keep everything together in my head straight as we go through the interview.
Fair enough. 60 feet under the ground. I think we're doing well so far. And no mobile phone reception, so it's a good
start.
Isn't
there?
Absolutely. It's one of the joys of being in a military bunker, I think.
Excellent. And we're in a military bunker here?
We are.
It looks quite plush and luxurious.
Somewhat transformed over the years, I must say. But actually the very last place to surrender against the Japanese in World War II. So historically significant. Used to be 24 of them in total. And we've renovated 8 and turned 2 of them into a private members club. And the remaining 6 form part of Crown Wine Cellars 1. And subsequently, of course, as you know, we've built 2, 3, and 4.
Can you give me a sort of the elevator pitch for what you do?
Sure. It's something that I started back in 2000. At that point, if you want the elongated story, I realized that Hong Kong owners, wine owners, probably owned around 15% of all the rare and fine wines in the world. But of course, almost 100% of those wines were kept in other locations. So the idea was to create an underground wine cellar with the theoretical aim of being the best in the world so that all these Hong Kong collectors would bring their wines back to Hong Kong. We had the added benefit in 2007 of the Hong Kong government reducing tax to zero. We have no GST in Hong Kong, VAT. So it became an extremely good place to relocate wines to. And since then, the company really has grown quite dramatically. So since starting 10 years ago, we now have 4 different facilities. And the simple idea is to be the best wine cellar and wine storage company in the world.
Are they all on Hong Kong mainland, your cellars?
They're all in Hong Kong mainland, but
Hong Kong Island, not
yes, to clarify, Crown Wine Cellars 1 is on the island itself of Hong Kong, which is a relatively small area. The vast majority of Hong Kong is on the peninsula of southern China, although it is Hong Kong territory. So we have 3 of our 4 facilities located on this mainland peninsula, pretty much near to the airport and ports. So obviously for relocation purposes, it makes a great deal of sense.
And what breakdown of wines? Is it the wines that people think they're going to drink up here near the members' cellars and the stuff for shipping?
It's a good question, Chris. I think certainly in the first three, four years, the majority were wines that people decided, let's bring them back to Hong Kong. In those days, we had a bonded cellaring, inland bonded facilities. But the primary idea was to consume those wines. In the last 3 years, however, the situation's changed quite dramatically. The Hong Kong auction market is now the second largest in the world, and this year it will definitely overtake New York to be the largest auction market in the world. Obviously, our secondary sales market for rare and fine wines, investment grade wines, is really enormous and growing larger all the time. So there's a great number of collectors that are deciding, look, the market is now here in Hong Kong. I can sell my wines very easily, and more importantly, I can sell them perhaps for a higher price than I could currently in UK, Europe, or the US, where the economies are pretty depressed. So a lot of these wines are finding their way back to Hong Kong for that reason.
You've been going since 2000, you said?
2000 was when the idea came forward. It took me 18 months just to get the business model going. And once I was pretty certain that, you know, I was onto something pretty good here and this could work, despite the fact that everyone, including my wife, mentioned that I may be mentally unstable for doing this, I found a mutually mentally unstable, a very wealthy man who was prepared to support it. And between us, we actually formed Crown Wine Cellars. So since then, that was around early 2004, late 2003. So the company is really only a couple of years old. Fortunately, it's supported by a $1 billion monolith company. So financially, we're pretty happy and sound, and now pretty profitable in our own right.
Okay, so you are profitable.
Yeah, within a relatively short time, given a new company structure, it has turned over a profit. But that's more to do with us being very lean and mean and pretty serious about what we're doing, rather than having some sort of pot at the bottom of a rainbow that would just develop money irrespective. There's a lot of storage companies in Hong Kong, and not all of us are profitable.
How many storage companies are there?
Well, we divide our storage companies into fine wine storage, commercial wine storage, and then a third category, which perhaps should not be mentioned.
They
would be places where you wouldn't want to put your wines. And that sort of exists worldwide, you know, in essence, converted warehouses just with a large air conditioner system or otherwise. But we have a fine wine and a commercial wine storage rating system in Hong Kong, which is the first of its kind internationally. And it was initiated by the Hong Kong government, but it's actually carried out by a group called the Hong Kong Quality Assurance Organization. And they do everything from testing seawater in fresh food restaurants to checking wine certification. So there are a bunch of very well-qualified scientists who don't suffer fools lightly. So when I say the fine wine side, I believe there's around five or six fine wine applicants. There's at least 12, perhaps 18 commercial wine potential applicants. And the rest of the facilities, as I say, would be regarded as unrated.
Okay, and they're more like warehouses that have...
Yeah, smaller people who've just started up and, you know, perhaps hold a couple of cases here and there, very cheap prices. Similar to what you'd find in the UK, somebody having a small shed available. It happens quite a lot in France as well. So there's absolutely no regulation. You take your chances, you get it done very, very cheap, but the potential damage is quite catastrophic if it happens.
I interviewed LiveX, the trading platform,
yes.
About a year or so ago, and they were quite particular about the wines that they sold through their platform.
Yes.
You know, they were only reasonably recent vintages,
right?
With reasonably well-known storage
provenance.
Facilities.
Yes.
Would you meet their requirements?
Oh, I think we'd supersede their requirements very, very easily. And again, I don't mean to sound arrogant, but when our fine wine certification program was started off, essentially it's taking inputs from all over the world as to what would be the best situation, the absolute pinnacle of wine cellaring and wine storage internationally, and applying that to a set of standards.
And what are those conditions?
Effectively, it works down to storage conditions of temperature at around about 13 degrees. It's humidity at around about 65-75%. Zero vibration, no natural light, but it also includes very important factors like having full insurance, for all the goods that are kept, having adequate inventory control, having adequate security, which includes high-definition cameras that have to record for up to 90 days, a lot of issues that are not usually taken on board when a customer would select a wine storage facility. So this organization now has galvanized all of these minimum requirements, put them into a document and said, well, if you want to be fine wine certified, you have to comply with all of those issues and you have to have an independent group of scientists, basically, who will come in there and do their own testing to make sure that what you claim is in fact true. And something like insurance, they'll want to see your insurance documentation, speak to your insurance cover.
Why 13 degrees aging wine?
13 degrees is the average between 14 for red and 12 for white. And this, if anybody does an internet search, you will get perhaps 2,000 hits on what is the correct temperature. The vast majority of those hits from winemakers and oenologists and otherwise, and perhaps wine journalists, people like Jancis Robinson, etc., would say that 14 for red, 12 for white is about the pinnacle of the balance between longevity, grape maturation, and the ability to hold its structure in the best way. So the 13, as I say, is just a balance between those two. You will get some people who will say 16 is fine. You'll get some people who, heaven forbid, will say 10 or 11 is fine. But by far the majority would agree that 13 is the optimal temperature.
What happens if the wine's, say, stored at 16 or 17 degrees versus 10?
Maturation just happens a lot faster. At 10, you would get wine retardation of the maturation process. So what you're looking for here is the perfect balance between not retarding it too much and not allowing it to advance too much, so that if you do indeed buy a 1961 Cheval Blanc that's rumored to be able to last for 100 years, that in fact you do drink it in 100 years' time and it tastes good. If you retard it too much, you're going to cause the maturation process unnatural damage by holding it back. And if you store it too hot at, say, 16, 17, 18 degrees, it's going to mature in 90 years, 80 years, 70 years, 60 years. And then at a certain point, you keep a wine that's too hot and it basically is just going to burn up. If you keep it too cold, you're going to cause irreparable damage to the wine.
What sort of damage, though, from being too cold? Because I always think of it as two separate processes. You've got the fruit evolution devolving into more the savory characteristics, and then you've got maybe acidity changing and tannins changing within the wine. Is it that they come out of harmony between those two, or what happens?
Well, too cold, two things are going to happen. If you consider something like an avocado pear, which is also a living organism with living cells inside, and it can die or mature at a certain point, if you or anybody else freezes an avo tomorrow morning to think that it's going to last for 2 weeks in your freezer and you'll pull it out, allow it to thaw and you'll be able to eat it, when you bring it out of the freezer, of course, all the meat will be black inside. A similar process in very simplistic terms would happen to wine. But not only that, when wine freezes in a bottle, it actually expands in volume and the cork gets pushed out. So in best case scenario, you're going to have air seeping in where there's minimal cork movement. But in a worst case scenario, the cork will actually come out and that'll be the end of the wine irrespective. But also the innards of the wine would basically be dead. So, and a very similar situation exists as well, of course, if you put it outside in the parking lot, inside the back window of your motor car, it's going to get direct sunlight, go up to 46 degrees, and just one day in the car like that, quite frankly, I wouldn't pay $1 for a bottle of wine like that.
I was interested when you talked about the standards that were being created for Hong Kong wine.
Right.
But you've got to get the wine to Hong Kong from France or wherever the wine's been made. And you are near the equator and it's going to get pretty hot. How do you ensure that the wines don't get cooked on the way down?
I think it's a very, very, very valid statement. But first of all, I want to point out both the UK and France reached 46 degrees in 2003. And as I mentioned to you, a great number of Frenchmen
died. I find it hard
to
believe England ever gets above 30.
Isn't it amazing? But, you know, thank God for records. They are there. So I must stress, you know, even if that happens to a bottle of wine for a very short period of time, it is going to cause damage. Of course, if I put wine into a standard container and took it across the equator, it's that 46 degrees multiplied by 10. It's really not good, and you'd probably kill your wines.
This happened to Madeira, isn't it? They used to stick it into casks and run it around the equator a bit,
yeah,
to cook it up.
Yeah, and probably for Madeira, a great old port, that's not such a bad thing. And ironically, if a wine is pretty young, it tends to be more robust. We're not sure why, but perhaps there's more energy left in the bottle or more longevity. I don't know. But certainly vintage wines do suffer more from heat-related damage. And compressed corks, which happens over time as well, they also tend to move a lot easier with vintage bottles because, of course, the cork does compress. In our situation, we only use refrigerated trucks and only use refrigerated containers. When I say refrigerated, we're not talking 5 degrees for your average refrigerator, but more set to around 15 degrees. And we put temperature sensors inside all of our containers, and we keep those sensor records when the wine arrives back in Hong Kong so that we can actually show owners that certainly from the time that we had control of the wines were looked after very well. I can also say that all the auction houses that are currently doing business in Hong Kong, all the biggest and the greatest like Sotheby's, Zaki's, Akamero Condit, those companies do the same thing as well. So this has become a almost across the board situation.
Has it always been like that?
No, the US really pioneered it back in the mid-80s and late 80s. There was a tremendous amount of criticism from the UK and Europe against American wines. And part of the precautionary measures that the US took in order to protect their collections was to start using reefer containers and to, of course, start controlling the temperatures of their warehouses. So the US pretty fast outstripped the conditions in the UK and Europe because of criticisms leveled against them. So by the time Hong Kong really began to take this seriously, and it's not that our wine market is only 10 years old. Our wine market is incredibly well developed over the last 40 years. It's just in the last 10 years we've aggressively started bringing our wines back home. And in that time, we looked at what was going on in the world and at that point immediately said the best way to do this is refrigerated containers, refrigerated trucks, extremely sophisticated wine cellaring and wine storage facilities. And as I say, as a result, these wines that have come into our care in the last 10 years really have enjoyed perhaps the best care they've ever had in their entire life.
Is that the way it is in other countries, like in the UK? I always get the impression that the storage, well, the fine wine storage is underground anyway. Is that a fair comment, or have I just not checked out enough of the storage facilities?
This is a very contentious an area, both for the UK and for France, because the average customer does believe that everything is stored in pristine underground cellaring, and of course that's not true. As far as the UK goes, the only major underground facility is Octavian's Corsham, but all the rest of Octavian's facilities are above ground warehouses. Likewise, London City Bond is above ground warehouses. Most of the facilities in France are above ground warehouses, some with AC, some not even so much as a fan. So my best comment would be, you know, the customer has to beware themselves. They need to ask questions. They need to be informed. We all have a great deal of money invested in our wines, whether it be emotional value for commercial wines that we just really love, or whether it be really, really expensive investment grade wines. And like you would a stock that you're buying on Dow Jones or wherever else, you need to investigate. You need to phone up your storage operator. You need to say, where exactly are my wines? What exactly does the building look like? How exactly are my wines cooled? Because 99% of the time, you're going to land up with a very big shock that it may actually just be an above-ground warehouse. There'd be not so much as a fan operating inside there. And it's not good enough to say our temperature conditions on average in the UK and France are compatible for wine storage. That's nonsense. When you go from minus 10 degrees in winter to 46 degrees in summer, even if it's for only 1 week, that is enough to destroy your wines. So ask questions. It's your right. In the same way that you would service your car at a dealer, you have the right to ask the dealer, is he certified? And that, what does that certification involve? And can I come and visit my car while it's being serviced? Really, really important. So take a day off. I mean, you know, these places are located in beautiful areas. Go and have a look.
Okay, mate. I think we'll wrap it up there, Greg.
Great stuff. Thanks very much, Chris. Bye. All the best.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Greg. I found Greg quite a fascinating fellow. I've got another interview which we'll go through at some point with him, more about Hong Kong wine trade than anything else. But Greg's got a very simple business, but they do it with quite a bit of style there. I think that's the way Hong Kong is. Lots of style. Speaking of style, we said that our mystery producer made a range of different styles earlier on. Did you have an idea who it is? It was, of course, Montana, New Zealand's largest producer. I'll give you the clues again. Montana was first established by Ivan Jakich, selling wine to American soldiers during World War II. He used the name Montana, meaning mountainous, as his vineyard lay on the slopes of the Waitakere Ranges west of Auckland. In the 1960s, his sons planted vines in Gisborne, and by the late 1980s led the way into the new region, Marlborough. Today, Montana is owned by Pernod Ricard and is the largest producer of wines in New Zealand. They have a range of wines at different prices, starting with their Classic range, their Reserve range, their Terroir series, Letter series, and of course, sparkling wines. Well, that pretty much ends the show this week. Just last thing is the quote, and this week it comes from Ernest Hemingway. Quite a famous person there, and he says that anyone who eats dessert isn't drinking enough wine. Quite a nice quote. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.